Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
In our current climate, as uncertainty reigns and consumer expectations evolve, a reliable basis for identity data is paramount. That's where our sponsor, TransUnion, comes in. TransUnion is a global information and insights company that makes trust possible by ensuring that each person is reliably yet safely represented in the market. Designed around the connected consumer, TransUnion leverages an accurate and comprehensive identity foundation and people-based technology that enables addressable consumer experiences for marketers and their key partners.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Zach Rogers, and I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger. So Operative is an ad management technology platform serving some of the world's largest media companies. We're talking about big customers, TV broadcasters and others, NBC Universal, ABC, AT&T, Starz, and they're global. They've also got Sky and Star India and others. Totaling about $40 billion in ad revenue. That's the revenue that's managed on their system annually. Operative CEO is a guy named Loren Brown. I've known Loren and talked to him off and on over the years. He's been at the company for, I think, about 19 years. He'll correct me if I'm wrong on that. But it wasn't always the same company. Loren founded and led Operative, the original Operative, for 10 or 15 years as an independent company. And then he sold it in 2016 to Syntech Media, which was a kind of an older legacy, if I may, revenue management software company. And later, Syntech was rebranded as Operative and with Loren as the CEO of the whole kit and caboodle. I'm delighted to have him on the podcast to talk about all of this, as well as what's happening with his business with COVID, as well as with the TV industry at large. Welcome, Loren. How you doing?
I am great, Zach. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Big fan.
Ha ha! You say that, but just before we went live, I learned Loren wasn't even a podcast listener until about 2 months ago, so I'm going to call you out.
That still makes it true. 60 days is officially a trend. I'm up 600%. I've now done 6 episodes compared to 0 pre-COVID. So,
well, now at least I have one fan, so that's great news. Before we jump in, let's talk a little about your background. Before you got into ad management tech, you worked in finance and technology. Could you talk a little bit about that early experience?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. When I graduated college in the 90s, I immediately went and worked for a company called CMP Media, which was based in Lake Success, Long Island. And they were one of the first magazines or magazine publishers to start to engage online advertising as a business model, and asked me to come in as a consultant. I had a technical background to deploy the first ad server, which at the time was NetGravity. Still the first ad server. Eventually that was bought by DoubleClick and called Dart Enterprise and eventually killed by Google. but that's what happens in 20 years. And when I went there to put the ad server in, it only took about a month, and they asked me to stay on, and I worked in their online advertising operations department. And it was a very interesting experience. I spent time doing inventory management and writing macros in Excel to predict inventory and decrement inventory and ad operations work, traditional, like, you know, ad trafficking and QA, and spent about 2 years doing that, and then decided that media wasn't for me.
Why?
A lot of what I was doing was very repetitive and manual. And I wasn't on the sales side, you know, and I soon found out later that being in ad sales was way more fun than ad ops. And decided to make a career change. And I went and worked for a financial software company called Royal Blue Technologies, which was based in Woking, England. If you've ever been to Woking, you can prepare to be very bored. But I went there to train and learn about the financial markets. And in this case, Royal Blue sold a product that supported equity traders at banks and brokerage houses. And I was joining as on their implementation team to go deploy the software at various banks, which I did for about 3 years, working at HSBC and lots of different financial institutions. And, you know, I met a gentleman on the trading floor who was a pioneer, was also a consultant, had his own business, and had had made a lot of money in the market data space as, you know, Bloomberg converted from closed sort of single terminal to open Bloomberg. You know, a lot of the disruption that took place in the financial markets, he was witnessing. And we were out for a drink one night, and I was just talking about the online advertising market and how fragmented and manual it was, and how the straight-through processing systems created for Wall Street were really desperately needed in the advertising space. And we decided that...
About what year was this?
This is in 1999.
Okay, very early.
Very early. And so in 2000, we launched Operative initially as an outsourced ad ops company because we had no outside capital to fund software development. So we spent 2 years doing outsourcing because it was there was such a big need. I mean, at the time, 99, 2000, I mean, you had companies looking for 100 traffickers at a single tranche. And so it was a very interesting market, and we made enough money to kickstart our software engineering. And eventually, by 2002, created the first sell-side ad management platform and product management system in the market. So that was original Operative and how we got started.
So now a lot of companies that founded around that time to serve media companies eventually became ad networks. But my understanding is that never happened with Operative. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, when you have a media business, you have to engage in multiple business models simultaneously. And the main business model at the time, and still today, for all premium media companies was the direct ad sales model. Now, you could say direct ad sales has become more automated and put fancy words in there. But at the end of the day, the relationships between brands, agencies, and the media owners is predominantly how people had made money. And what ad networks were just another outlet to do backfilling and take unsold inventory and put it in places where they can get some demand and make money in places where, you know, maybe they'd be serving house ads and things like that. So for Operative, we always wanted to be the company that helps media businesses with their direct advertising business. And by doing that, we kind of put ourselves on the other side of the fence as opposed to being a traditional ad tech company. That
did you ever consider an ad network as a side business?
Never. Okay. You know, it was something that we were very religious about because we always wanted to be a trusted ally to the media companies. We never wanted to be in a situation where we were competing with them. And so everything that we've done is aligned with their ability to be successful. If they're successful, we're successful.
Got you. And how did you charge your customers back in those early days? Was it always software revenue or did you have a different model?
It was always software revenue. We charge seat licenses, and that's always been our predominant model. We've messed around with other types of transaction SaaS models, but predominantly it's been a seat license-based business.
How did the business evolve? You started in digital. Now you, as we're going to learn, position predominantly as a television platform. But could you talk a little bit? You don't need to jump ahead to the present day, but prior to the merger with Syntech Media, how did Operative evolve?
Yeah, so somewhere around 2010, 2011, Operative was really the main player in the digital market. And you know, when we talked about digital back then, we even then talked about it as all impressions-based media, right? So not just banners, but you know, large companies like Turner and NBC and CBS who were selling you know, video on demand, as well as OTT and other impression-based mediums. And what they really were looking for was a way to bring all that together and sell audiences across all their impressions-based inventory. We got really good at that. But in the process, we picked up a large number of accounts that had traditional TV and linear businesses. And the only way for us to really help media companies do what we know they needed to go do, which was sell as a portfolio to bring linear and digital together, was through integrations. And so we certainly had conversations with Syntech Media at the time, who was the leader in linear ad sales and traffic systems. We had conversations with Wide Orbit. And, you know, honestly, all we were trying to do was set up integration strategies that allowed us to kind of help bring linear and digital together. But at the end of the day, without owning the tech, without owning a single product catalog, we knew we couldn't do it just on our own. And so we were approached by a private equity firm called Francisco Partners, who happened to own another company called Syntech Media. And we started talking with Francisco, and they had a vision where if they were able to combine Operative and Syntech, that we can bring linear and digital together. And certainly, that was exactly what we were looking for. Management was very excited about what we were doing. And, you know, we had venture capital companies that were inside of Operative at the time, who had been some there for over 10 years. We were largely owned by a company called Edison Ventures. And, you know, for Edison, they were looking for an exit. So for us, timing was good. We had strategic opportunities to go take on. Management was excited, and we were able to clear the venture group off the table. So we got bought by FP. And, you know, we marketed it that. $200 million deal. Yeah. We marketed that as Syntech buying Operative because we wanted the customers to understand really what the vision was going to be. But in reality, Francisco Partners bought Operative and merged us with Syntech Media.
Understood. Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And how did you end up CEO? Was that always part of the plan, or did it come about afterwards?
Well, they pitched it to me as always being part of the plan before we did the deal.
What, did you find out otherwise when you got...
No, actually quite the opposite. So,
okay.
The previous CEO of Syntech Media, Amot Yarden, currently now on the Operative board, I came in and worked for him as president of the new company. And the plan was over the next couple of years to transition, you know, the CEO role to me. But, you know, as a lot of things in our industry, things happen really, really fast. The board, as well as the executive team, wanted to move much faster on our cloud native strategy. And what we were really doing was building a new platform that would sit on top of linear and on top of the digital system that each one of our respective companies had, and create a new platform that would be fully converged to support all new business models, but also the traditional business models, because we know change doesn't happen overnight. And obviously, you know, my background is in SaaS. And so, you know, we all agreed that why wait to start our future? Let's get this going. And so I took over as CEO, and Emote's moved to the board.
Okay, got you. So let's just plow through a few brief questions on the business today. How has the competitive set changed? I mean, you mentioned Wide Orbit. I believe they were acquired by MediaOcean along the way, weren't they? Could you talk a little about who the key competitors are?
Yeah, no problem. So Wide Orbit is still a non-public company. They were not purchased by MediaOcean.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, they have done partnerships with many companies, but they're still privately held. They're a good company. I think I've known Eric for a long time. I think he's doing a good job. But they're a much different company than us. You know, Wide Orbit, you know, predominantly is in the local stations market, and they made a bet on programmatic selling, which is something that, you know, as I said earlier in the session, that's just something we never wanted to do for many different reasons. But we did want to solve something.
Why not?
Well, again, it kind of puts you on the side of the table that can be competitive with your customers, right? So I believe that the new programmatic marketplaces should be the media companies, the largest ones, Comcast, NBC, Xander, Turner. And, you know, those are the companies that have data, they have addressable capabilities, and they have the ability to be the ideal partner for media companies that aren't as big, but need access to their capabilities.
So that's an endorsement of the walled garden approach, where you shouldn't have independent programmatic platforms in television. The media companies should run their own closed systems.
Yeah, you could kind of think about it as a world that's evolving into a federated marketplace where everyone's going to rely, they're going to need each other. I guess the U.S. is not a great example of that right now, but traditionally it has been, where you have, you know, a national government and states that have their own autonomy. So if I'm, let's say, a mid-sized TV company and I want to sell my own inventory, but there's certain inventory I'm just going to give to Xander and I'm going to give it to Comcast, or I'm going to give it to, let's say, a Spectrum Charter, because they can get more from my inventory by using their set-top box data. Well, I'm going to have a hybrid model. And by the way, I might work with multiple cable operators, and probably will. Mm-hmm. So for us, we're much better off, in our opinion, helping media companies become marketplaces, not programmatic ad tech companies, you know, which are glorified ad sales rep firms, compete with the customers. So, you know, for us, the biggest thing to solve is this stack issue. I mean, this is what makes us different from everyone else. And when I say stacks, I mean that media companies have always been set up where you have a stack of ad tech people in process for digital, a stack of ad tech people in process for linear. And now you have things forming for programmatic and things forming for addressable and OTT. And this is not a very scalable infrastructure. It prevents unification. It prevents portfolio selling. It drains EBITDA and impacts gross margin. And so if you want to compete in the new market, you have to aggregate that supply chain. So while you can go across one of those to support an existing market, when a portfolio deal comes your way or an audience deal comes your way that requires you to go across all platforms, going vertically across those stacks is very, very difficult. So our entire competitive set is designed at solving that problem.
Gotcha. And then what business metrics can you disclose? I mean, it's been 4 years since the merger. Do you have any revenue or other figures you released publicly?
Yes, I can share some data with you. I think, you know, one thing I can say is that, you know, we're private equity held. So, you know, we don't disclose financial metrics, but like all private equity firms, you know, we're required to maintain certain levels of EBITDA and innovate at the same time. In 2018, we grew nicely into 2019. So that was a period where a lot of tech companies were not seeing good growth. You know, and because we're a SaaS business, we do long-term contracts with people, and they want to do long-term contracts with us because they want predictability into what a business management platform like us is going to do for them. And so, you know, with COVID and everything else going on, it's a good time to be a software company, because people are relying on us now more than ever before with remote workforces. And if you had a traditional linear system that you needed to access in the early stages of COVID, you were having a tough time doing that because you had a VPN and an abnormal amount of users from their home into the networks to be able to access these systems. So, you know, we're really lucky and fortunate to have a SaaS business. We've seen an uptick in users. And another interesting statistic is that our engineering and development teams are up 135% versus last year. And, you know, I could say it's probably a combination of less meetings or more efficient meetings, more adoption of our collaboration tools, as well as, you know, maybe things like no commute time. So I think we're trying to strike the right balance here. But I think you're seeing that kind of trend across a lot of companies where they're becoming a lot more efficient in areas where they weren't before, or much more efficient than their baselines.
Okay, great. Now that's a nice transition into a little discussion of COVID and its impact, not only on your customers, but the industry at large. I think you'll have great perspective there. But first, we're going to hear a special message from our sponsor. I'll be right back with Lauren Brown. Hi, and I'm talking to Matt Spiegel, EVP Marketing Solutions and head of the media vertical at TransUnion, our sponsor for this month. Matt, as addressability increases and companies better learn how to leverage their own data, how can traditional data suppliers evolve to help navigate these new needs?
Yeah, thanks, Zach. I mean, one of the things we're really focused on is being more than just an access point to data. We're both building the technology tools to combine with the data that's necessary for activation of data, whether that's around targeting, measurement, or other use cases. Really, our focus and our mission is to really enable marketers to become people-based experts. And we believe that's a lot about providing that mix of technology and data.
All right. Now, advertisers value the idea of a consumer-centric view. How do you see them using data partnerships to get better at activation in a cookieless world?
Well, it really starts with the understanding of making sure you're leveraging a true identity graph, one that's built on the understanding of individuals and households, not just devices. And once you have that accurate view of identity, building on top of it, by having access to the incremental data at your fingertips as you need. Certainly, you want to leverage as much as your own data as you can, but that's not going to provide all the intelligence you need. And our bet is that many marketers will look to be able to have technology integrations that allow for easy access to data at the time of need, and that there'll be a focus on quality data built from accurate identity.
All right. The TV ecosystem has always operated without cookies. With the global pandemic resulting in more individuals staying in and consuming media, how do you see these two trends converging for advertisers as they need to understand the household grows?
Yeah, you know, fundamentally, I think this importance of understanding the connected home is really key. As people work in the CTV ecosystem, there is a reality of understanding just how fragmented access points are. And there really is a fundamental need to understand how to leverage a true understanding of people and ultimately households. And we think, especially over the next 6 to 12 months, there's going to be a lot of room for new advertisers. And many of those advertisers are going to be those that are really direct to consumer focused. And these advertisers are historically more data driven, more digitally savvy, aren't going to expect their CTV partners to be anchored in identity and provide that ability to create micro segments. That's what they typically use to drive more marketing performance, and we think that will be key.
All right, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm back with Lauren. So regarding the impact of COVID, I wonder if you could step back for a minute. It's great news that many SaaS businesses are, you know, better positioned right now. And part of that is just any churn they experience or customer loss as a result of COVID has a sort of a delayed effect, right? It's not going to be this quarter. It might be, you know, whenever the contracts were signed, I'm presuming. I wonder though if you could step back and speak to the impact overall that you're seeing on media companies and, you know, advertiser budgets during this time. It's something we're all trying to draw a bead on, and it's obviously a moving target.
Yeah, we have a unique perspective on this because we represent a platform that could help media companies change the way they do business. And what we've seen is a decade of trends in basically 18 months. And, you know, I like to talk a little bit about crisis in general. You know, I think crisis is something that other industries and even humans have had to deal with for a very long time. And I think it's an important thing to note that humans have been dealing with crisis for thousands of years, personal crisis, global crisis. And I think one of the things about a crisis is it makes you stronger and really defines who you are today. So for me personally, you know, I've had issues in my life where I had to start to think about what I was going to do differently. And I gravitated to meditation, and that changed my life. And one of the things that I incorporated into that meditation is an intention setting, an I am phrase of, you know, what would already be happening if I can visualize that and what good looks like and start to march to that and change every day to that. And, you know, I'm sure you could think about something, or the listeners can think about something that happened in their life that forced change. And I think innovation and personal crisis is similar. But the difference is, in personal crisis, there's urgency. And until now, industry crisis really required just a bunch of good ideas and for you to run towards that, run towards those ideas in advance of acute pain. And interestingly enough, here we are in acute pain, where I think innovation has typically been harder. I actually think it's pretty straightforward right now. And Mark Twain, I've used this quote over and over again, said, never let a crisis go to waste. And so, you know, what we're really seeing in media is the rating, the decline of the rating point, which Nielsen had held together in TV. The days of high gross margin TV businesses are gone. The people intensive is no longer okay. And when it bounces back, TV companies, digital companies, any premium company is going to have to reprove the value of their media. And so we're going to see a lot more digital targeting, outcome buying, and it's really a new yield equation. And I am a really big believer that premium will win in the end, and they're going to do so by taking share from Facebook and Google. And okay. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I just want to pause there because I think it's very interesting what you just said about how innovation and change are driven by, you know, in people's personal lives, often a crisis. In business, at least in throughout most of the life of the internet, it's been driven more by opportunity and venture capital. And there have only been a few instances, you know, over the last 25 years where business crisis led to technology change, at least in the West, at least, you know, in the United States. And I think one of them was the recession in 2008, 2009, which is where we saw a big acceleration of programmatic, and where programmatic buying replaced traditional media, digital investments really accelerated. And so right now we're in a second, arguably much worse wave of business crisis, where what's driving the change is not innovation and opportunity, but a real sort of survival urge. Like, it's change or die for a lot of companies. So I think that's fascinating. And then, so I would love to hear you talk for a minute about how that plays out. And I don't mean to disrupt your flow there, because you were in the middle of making a point. So feel free to continue there. But I would like to have a little discussion about what exactly that could mean, that accelerated change from the standpoint of television.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think a great example you can use is Google, right? If Google could make a classifieds business worth $50 billion, what could premium media do with better tech, better data, better targeting? And like the layman's version analogy, which I like to use, is like a baseball analogy. So, you know, in baseball has gone through innovation too. I think we've all read or watched the movie Moneyball, right? Where a bad team could beat a good team because they realized that just getting on base with a walk was as good as a hit. And, you know, some teams were able to beat better teams on paper because they leveraged the strategy, but then the better teams leveraged the strategy too. And then all of a sudden, you know, got back on top. And the other example is the open reliever, right? If I start my reliever in the first inning, I have a higher chance of winning, and you know, bad pitchers beat good pitchers on good teams until the other team started putting this strategy in place. And in media, it's really the same thing. With Facebook and Google, the content is not good, but they have the tools and they're winning. And their innovation largely remains unadopted by premium media companies. And so the point is like, tools and strategies are deployable, but companies must innovate to unlock the modern day value of premium is to come out on top. And it's really just about taking a play from the other team's book or another industry's book. If you look at what happened in retail, you know, Amazon was a force to be reckoned with, and they forced companies like Walmart and Target to eliminate their complexity and aggregate their supply chain and partner with good companies to help them tech innovation. And you know, the airline industry is another good example. And you know, media, you know, look at what's happening in the upfronts. You know, if you go from an 80% upfront to a 50% upfront, you're now going from a 20% scatter to a 50% scatter. That's starting to look a lot more like the airline business.
Is that what you think is happening with the upfront this year? It's down from 80 to 50?
I think it's going to be something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not going to be the 80-20. And you know, if you look at the airline industry, you can buy it seat by seat from day one. So it's like 100% scatter in a way. And the TV business has been the opposite, but now it's going to look a lot more like that. So the yield equation, the packaging equation, the way you sell as a portfolio, and you know how you're going to use pieces of inventory with different buyers is now much more important than ever.
So there's an opportunity to innovate out of this sense of urgency and better compete with these large platform companies. But there's nowhere near the number of engineers and developers. And I wonder, you know, just briefly, could you speak to that? Like, do media companies really have a chance here?
Well, we believe we give them a good chance. And there's other companies out there that do as well. I mean, from our standpoint, if you just look at other industries, what have they done? They've invested in cloud technology. And I don't mean taking old systems on old on-prem data centers and moving them into the cloud. I mean applications that have been developed for the internet, that are open, that are configurable, that are willing to work with others, where you can actually remove these on-site monolithic software technologies that are Oracle dependent, sysadmins, large IT staffs. I mean, this is really old stuff, right? So that's just one, is like modernize your stack. And within that modernization, you can start to do things that are much more aligned with open, configurable, and portfolio selling. So you saw not too long ago, NBC launched their One Platform in the marketplace. And Operative is a major part of One Platform. It's helping them take their data, their tech, and use that as an advantage. You know, with us having a true operating system with a universal product catalog and our ability to manage complexity and hide that complexity from buyers and support a portfolio selling model, which allows people to go across all properties, linear and digital, single view. Yeah, I think it gives them a really good chance. And you know, we have almost 1,000 engineers working across our data centers literally 24 hours a day. So, you know, we think that we've been prepared just for this moment. And, you know, we think the premium media companies who have great content, it's just a matter of, you know, embracing innovation. But to your point, it has to be done very, very quickly because the usual ramp period is not here, right? COVID has pretty much eliminated that.
All right, now, and what about the whole factor of sports media and advertising? I feel, if we're comparing the opportunity for media companies to Google's innovation, I mean, this would be as if Google had lost half its search index or something, just a colossal blow against broadcasters. What do you think will be the impact of that this year, next year? I realize you can't read the future.
Well, it's a colossal blow, but it's not 50%. You know, I think sports viewership roughly makes up on average only about 10%, you know, but obviously that's not proportional to the amount of money they make from it. And so it's also and certainly an opportunity because sports is gone for everyone, but advertisers still want those sports viewers. And this is where, you know, I know we might talk about measurement, but you know, Nielsen is just not really good enough anymore, you know, because the sports viewers are still out there. And, you know, they just need to be accessible. And you've got large cable operators like Comcast, like Effective, which is Comcast Advertising. They've been out there trying to put advertisers into sports audiences for years. And advertisers have just wanted to buy sports. But they've had this playbook. And so now when advertisers want to reach sports, they have no other choice but to access sports viewers, the audience of sports, and where are they? And so companies like Comcast can say, 80% of the people that watch Monday Night Football are in these three shows. And here's the data to back it up. And now people can't get enough of that. So a lot of it is being offset. And I actually think that the yield equation, especially for like a station group or a cable operator who's embracing impressions and embracing audience selling, is going to really be able to make a lot of use out of this, because advertisers are going to see that, oh, wait a minute, if I just find the same sports users adjacent to premium content, but I buy audiences instead, and that still helps me hit my campaign goals, huh, I might be able to do that long-term too. So while I think that there's some short-term issues on revenue, that goes without saying, I really do believe that media companies are going to be better off, especially cable operators and station groups, because they have such a strong ability to access leverage data to sell audiences.
One of the well-known issues with sort of advanced television, connected TV buying and audience buying in television is for the issue of frequency measurement and management, and making sure from a marketer point of view, they're not hitting their audience. They're not over targeting the same audience. How optimistic are you that that's, given the fragmentation that still exists in television and the walled garden factor, which seems to be an inevitable part of TV's future, how solvable is this frequency problem?
Well, certainly if you fast forward to the end, when everything's IP-based, it's extremely solvable, right? It's been solved in, digital, right? It's pretty easy to frequency cap campaigns. Now, when you sell an audience across a portfolio and are trying to get unduplicated reach, or you're trying to do frequency capping and things like that, it gets a bit harder because things are still fragmented from a delivery standpoint. You know, I'm still delivering my linear inventory via a traffic system that talks to a playout facility, and I only have the ability to change those campaigns a day before the campaign airs. Whereas if you're selling video or delivering video, I can quite easily do frequency capping and have that talk to my DMP, no problem. So I think over time it's going to get better, but I don't think it needs to be perfect. I think it just needs to be good enough because, you know, TV companies, the premium companies that are selling video, which includes digital companies, if the content's premium, it's just going to be better than some of the content that's socially generated on Facebook and Google.
All right, got you. And now, so from an audience standpoint, the TV audience and the reachable TV audience, I think there are a lot of people who are wondering what the future of ad-supported television is. AVOD in recent years appears to be growing more slowly than SVOD, subscription video. And then we have this other issue of young people and the kind of share of their attention that's going to video games and YouTube and other platforms, digital platforms versus television viewing. So I feel like those two things kind of go together a bit, in that it speaks to, hey, how large is the ad-supported television audience going forward? Is there anything that you could say on that, Lauren?
Yeah, you know, I think it all gets mixed into the soup, right? I think that what we've seen is linear viewership down, let's say, 2% year over year. TV, linear TV projected to be down 16%, I think, in the next 5 years. And they've been largely able to hold price, but that's going to be short-lived. And I think things like COVID are definitely exposing that. And the way that they grow, and I don't just mean grow back to where they were, I mean, you know, really grow year over year revenue, is to go across all inventory types and devices, smarter pricing, smarter packaging and bundling. And, things like, AVOD, and any type of new way that you're going to, consume content and therefore ads, all needs to be mixed into a single portfolio. And to me, that's, you know, the $70 billion of money that's been spent in television, you know, that money is going to shift around. So some of that will go to, you know, VOD environments. But the reality is that the biggest pot of money that sits out there is in direct response. $100 billion being spent on the large digital companies that don't have premium content. And in order to get that, I need to expand my portfolio as big as I possibly can, regardless of platform. And so, you know, a VOD is just a great way for premium to embrace how consumers want to watch TV, but make sure they capture that. And when they do capture those users, make sure that they can be monetized alongside everybody else. And more data, smarter packaging, and better delivery capabilities are really going to, you know, help them. So I don't see this as like a new binary thing that, you know, they're going to start to put out, you know, NBC when they launched Peacock, right? I know that they want to combine Peacock viewership with total viewership and do some exciting things for advertisers that way, not just let people cherry pick off of Peacock.
Gotcha. So Lauren, what advice, last question, what advice would you give somebody who's starting a career in media right now or thinking about it?
Learn how to program. learn Java. You know, I really think that the media industry, I really mean, you know, when I say a decade of trends in 18 months, it's really, things are really expediting. And when you have, you know, if you look at just digital alone, 50% of a sales planner's time is spent doing manual work. Same thing on the agency side. And all this manual work in television and digital has been largely absorbed by high gross margins and volume. And, you know, all that's going away. People can't afford to have so many people supporting these business lines anymore. And so it's really time to start embracing, you know, technology. You know, we've done some significant partnerships with other companies like MediaOcean, where we're trying to automate as much as we can between the buy and the sell side. And I think you're just going to see so much more of that. And what a TV infrastructure looks like or a digital company's infrastructure looks like is just going to be significantly different. There's the ability to not just automate, but on the other side of the rainbow, embrace machine learning and AI, where I could start to put, you know, based on audiences I want to reach, this goes back to the sports example, you know, I could suggest to you the optimal way for you to reach that audience, you know, based on your requirements. And really not a lot of people are going to need to be involved in that process. You'll still have big custom deals. You'll still have people to make decisions and relationships and things like that. But, you know, much like other industries, the supply chain is going to be very automated. And you're going to see a lot more media companies embrace innovation. And therefore, I think, you know, SaaS technology companies is a really smart place to invest. And I think you're going to see a lot of big media companies starting to hire more and more developers to make sure that their special sauce, their ecosystem of data and commercial apps can be integrated into companies like Operative, but also integrated into their buyers, the agencies and the brands who also want to buy much more efficiently, strategic, and in an integrated way.
Gotcha. All right. Well, fascinating discussion. Lauren Brown, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, man. Great fun. Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of this podcast. We'll see you next time.
Tune in next week to hear more from TransUnion. With a comprehensive identity graph and its true audience platform, TransUnion provides an end-to-end ecosystem for people-based marketing that delivers identity resolution and expansion, flexible data uploads, a powerful audience builder, machine learning modeling, 360-degree insights, and omni-channel distribution. Visit transunion.com/industry/media to learn more. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.